You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East, chatting with MLB.com's five NL East beat reporters about a race that's kind of crystallized a little bit. The Nationals have really established themselves as the heavyweight in the division. The Braves are trying to keep track and very much in play in the wild card race. The Marlins are still in the wild card race, and the Mets and Phillies are trying to decide what they want to do with the remainder of their seasons, whether it's time to look ahead to next year, whether it's time to try some guys out, and really what to do with these last 5 weeks of the season. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be talking some ball with five beat reporters. Let me talk to the Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Bill Ladson. Bill, about 2 or 3 years ago, I wrote a big feature on how the Nationals pitching staff was all about guys who blew you away, guys with some huge pitch, some strikeout pitch, guys who racked up the strikeouts. Just a couple years later, it's a completely different-looking pitching staff. They're not near the top of the league in strikeouts. They don't walk anybody, though. They throw strikes. Is that transition by design, or is that something that just happened?
I think it's something that just happened because I still think it's the case of the Nationals walk guys who can blow people away. That's still the case. If you remember, Jordan Zimmerman was a guy who used to blow people away when he first came up. But then after having the Tommy John surgery, he just decided, hey, just throw strikes, let him hit the ball, and then I can get outs that way. Strasburg, in a sense, is that way as well now, where he has games where he can just let the hitters just hit the ball and try to get ground ball outs. But I think it's not by design. I just think it's just happened to be that way.
It's an odd mix since they're a decent defensive team, but they're not a great defensive team. I mean, is that something when they talk about putting a club together, it seems like if you've got a high strikeout staff, you can get away with decent defense. If you've got a low strikeout staff, you really need to catch the ball. I know it's something you wrote about a lot last year, how they needed to get better defensively. Do you think they're still where they – do you think they're where they want to be at defensively, or do you think this is still a priority that maybe they want to be a little bit tighter defensive club?
Matthew, they are much improved. I mean, they got off to a bad start defensively. But now I would say since maybe starting in May – that's when they really started to improve. They're like in the middle of the pack now. I mean, they started off like way in the bottom. But now defensively, they have looked great. Yeah, they make miscues once in a while. But I'm telling you, Matthew, I think it's much better than what it was early in the season.
The Nationals are getting ready to starting a pretty healthy road trip here. How valuable is it, do you think, for a club with a healthy lead to get big challenges? I remember it was something that I used to see some of the Cardinal teams I covered, that they'd have a big lead and you worry a little bit about complacency and you get that challenge of a team that was in the hunt and kind of get everybody's attention. Do you think there's value to a road trip like this for a team in the Nationals position?
I think there's no question about it, Matthew. To me, you know, I think this is their toughest road trip of the season. And yes, I know the Phillies are in last place, but they're a tough team. They always play the Nationals tough. Then they play Seattle, who are in the wild card hunt, and then they play the Dodgers. And I think, to me, once they play the Dodgers, I think that will determine how far the Nationals can go. I think the Dodgers are one of the toughest teams that they'll play this year, and you know, they have to face the Clayton Kershaws of the world. I think it's going to be really, really tough for the Nationals, and we'll see how far they can go.
What is your anticipation of how that trip goes and how they match up with those clubs?
Well, I mean, you know, when I look at Seattle, it's the pitching. I think my biggest concern about the Nationals is having consistent offense. And that's been a problem the last 2 years. And I think it'll be interesting to see how they face a team like the Seattle Mariners, who have great pitching, as well as the Dodgers. I think looking at the offense more than anything else, in these two series, just to see if they can remain consistent. I just had an interview with Matt Williams today, and he, you know, I told him that I felt that the biggest concern was the offense because it's been up and down the last 2 years. So you hope they can be consistent, really starting today.
It's an interesting offense because there's really not a superstar. I mean, Rendon's probably the closest thing to a star-caliber player, and yet it's so deep top to bottom. Do you think that makes a team tougher to match up with in the postseason, or do you think that absence of one guy that terrifies you, it maybe makes makes a team an easier offense to pitch to?
Well, Matthew, I think they're a tough team to pitch to right now because, you know, it's so funny you're asking me this because I asked Matt Williams this today, is that, you know, when he was a player, he was a power hitter. But now, as a manager, he's not relying on power. This team is winning basically on small ball, being aggressive on the bases, hitting up the middle. I think that's a better medicine, a remedy to have against some of these pitchers in the National League. And they're not relying on the long ball like in 2012 on the Davey Johnson, who relied on the three-run homer. And I think that could go well, bode well for the Nationals.
It's interesting that you mentioned small ball, though. There was a piece today by Joe Shea in his newsletter today was about the Nationals. And one of the things he pointed out that I thought was really interesting was that the Nationals, although they Williams doesn't preach that swing for fences, he also hasn't given away a lot of outs. You know, they don't bunt very much. They've lost very few outs, you know, on caught stealing. They are protective of their outs. Philosophically, where do you think Williams kind of falls on that kind of play for one run small ball stuff?
You know, Matthew, I think he's aggressive, but he is careful. You know, we've seen, like, for example, Denard Span try to steal third. He's thrown out. I've seen him get picked off as well. But I think he's right up the middle there. I just think that Matt Williams will do anything he can to win the game. And the one thing which is shocking is that he's not going for the home run. He's happy what he has. When he goes for rallies, for example, like the sixth inning against the Giants Sunday, the thing he was most impressed with that there were no home runs hit. So I think by, you know, like being more aggressive on the bases and just going up the middle, that's why this team is winning right now. And he's happy about that.
It's an interesting balance where, you know, you don't want to go for too much, but you also don't want to give outs away. I guess to some extent that's almost the ideal balance is that you don't have guys swinging from their behinds, but you're also not throwing away outs.
No, not at all. And, you know, the amazing thing too, Matthew, I think the coaching staff has to get credit for this because, you know, Denard Spann, he admitted himself, he was not a good base dealer with the Twins. It wasn't until really this year where he really improved. He's going to set a career high in stolen bases, and I think he's going to have one of his best seasons ever. And, you know, it brings up to your point where they're being more aggressive and getting less outs.
What is the difference for a guy who's always clearly had that speed? You say he's a better base stealer. Is that picking his spots? Is that reading the pitchers? What goes into a guy who clearly has the ability turning it into a skill rather than just a tool?
Yeah, I think it's reading the pitcher, timing the pitcher, and also I have to say Tony Tarasco has played a huge role in that. If you talk to Denard Span, no one has helped him more than Tony Tarasco, who's a base stealer himself when he played. And I think that's the big difference. Denard Span doesn't guess anymore the way he used to. I think if you talk to him, he'll say he's a better ball player now than he was with the Twins. And, you know, he's a better hitter, more consistent, and by far a better base dealer for sure.
It's interesting because there were points last year where that didn't look like the best move. I mean, he certainly did some things really well last year, led the league in triples, and I don't want to run the guy down, but there were times last year where you kind of wondered if they'd gotten the leadoff hitter that they thought they were getting, and he's having such a good year this year. What do you think is the difference between Span in 2013 and Span in 2014?
Well, the reason is he's going back to the way he used to hit with the Twins. A lot of his hits are to the opposite field. He did a lot of that in Minnesota, and he's not really going for power or anything. He's really using his speed a lot, too. He's getting a lot of infield hits. He's getting a lot of bunt hits. And I just think, you know what, if I had to pick an MVP, he would be one of them, him and Rendon. They've been that good. He's also improved his on-base percentage. That's the big difference as well. He's more patient at the plate, and that's the biggest improvement to me.
Right, that's the thing that stands out, is rather than just being a speed guy, he's really been a true leadoff guy, and that was something this club had lacked for quite a long time.
You know, no question about it. I would say, I'm going on record to say, Matthew, that he is definitely the best leadoff hitter they ever had. And the best one prior to that was Brad Wilkerson, but he struck out too much. He had a high on-base percentage, but just struck out way too much. And Denard Span rarely strikes out, so he's been a pretty good hitter in that sense.
All right. Well, Ladson, thanks for taking some time to chat Nationals here on MLB.com Extras. We're talking some Atlanta Braves with MLB.com's Braves reporter, Mark Bowman. Mark, we talked about Mike Minor last week, and the indications were turning positive as it was, and he turns around and flirts with a no-hitter. That's three good starts in a row and four out of five. How many do you need to see before you believe that this guy's really sorted out?
I think Friday night's outing there in Cincinnati, like you said, when he took the no-hit bid there into the eighth inning, I think that was all I needed to see. Just not just as just that one game, but just that was the topper. You know, it showed that this is not. I don't think this is a fluke. I think he has his confidence back, and nobody's ever said he's going to be an ace, but I think he is a legitimate number three who has the capability of pitching it like a strong number two on a consistent basis. And, you know, that's what this rotation needs. And here's a guy who he entered into this season. He had posted a 2.90 ERA in his previous 47 starts. That's not a fluke, you know. So what we saw over the first few months of the season, you know, I think it was just a guy who got behind schedule at the beginning of the season, struggled. He had a chance to clear the game this month, and I do think he will be an asset down the stretch.
So, if Minor's good, if he's right, we've talked about the kind of all-over-the-place nature of this club more than once, but let's kind of get ahead of ourselves a little bit. This team's not far out of the wild card at all. They're right in that mix. So, they get in, they win that one game. You've got Teron, you've got Minor, who seems to be pitching like a 2-3 kind of guy. You've got Irvin Santana, who's been very good most of the year. You've got Alex Wood, whose upside is enormous. Isn't this a rotation that matches up with pretty much any in the NL, with the exception of the Dodgers, as a playoff rotation?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I don't think there are going to be any other rotations in the National League that do match up with the Dodgers. Like you say, whoever goes up against Kershaw, Greinke and company, they're going to say, oh, you know, advantage Dodgers. But this is a rotation that can hold its own against most of the other National League teams. We've seen that they fared well against the Nationals over the last 2 years, especially the success they had against Strasburg and Gio. You start putting Fister against Teron, and if you put Roark against Wood or Zimmerman against Santana. I mean, those are all matchups where you say, you could argue one way or another for this either guy. There would not be any kind of decided disadvantage. And in all honesty, there are a couple guys right there that I would probably give the advantage to the Braves. So, every other team besides the Dodgers, I think you're going to find that. So, I think that Alex Wood is a wild card down the stretch. You know, if he stays strong, we'll see how important it was those 6 weeks that they took him out of the rotation to limit his innings and keep him strong for the stretch run. It's going to be interesting to see how effective he is down the stretch because he can be a difference maker.
So if we're talking about playoff matchups, it must follow that it's also about time to start talking about awards. And don't worry, I'm going to say something nice about him in just a minute. But can we dispense with this Justin Upton MVP talk in a world where Giancarlo Stanton still has two legs and two arms and suits up every day?
Yeah, I wrote something yesterday. I said, hey, look, Justin Upton's having a great season. You know, it's good, but he's not an MVP candidate. He's going to have to do something crazy in September. And in all honesty, if you ask me who the MVP is of this team every day, it's Jason Hayward just for what he does. Since moving to the leadoff spot, with what he's done in the field throughout the season with his glove, and it's Justin Upton's having a great season. But like I said, I don't even think see him as the MVP of the team.
With that said, he is absolutely raking. And it seems like for really his whole career, he's been a very streaky guy. To your eye, as somebody sees him every day, what's the difference between good Justin and bad Justin?
You know, I think probably and it's going to sound simple, but it's just having an understanding of the strike zone. When you start seeing him swinging at bad pitches, you kind of get a feel for him losing touch with the strike zone. You're probably going to see a guy who struggles for a couple of weeks. When you see Justin Upton start, swinging at primarily strikes, not chasing balls out of the zone, and most importantly, if you ever start seeing him go to the opposite field, maybe once a game, maybe once every other game, he just like most other people, when they do that, he's locked in. It is amazing how many some of the tremendous stretches that he's had over the last 2 years have been. You're thinking this guy's the greatest player in the world, and then for 3-4 weeks to follow, you're thinking, this guy really isn't doing anything but being a detriment in the middle of the lineup. So, for the most part this year, I will say this. Last year we saw more of the swoons last longer, and he's had much the lack of productivity lasted longer last year, I guess is the best way to say it. And this year, I think what we've seen is, you're not going to see the guy. It's on the tear that he's on right now throughout the season. Nobody ever does that. But we haven't seen him dip down into the 230, three home runs and, whatever, 690 OPS for 40 games either.
The flip side of that, and I don't want to pile on B.J. Upton because enough people have done that, unfortunately, but it's gone real, real bad again for B.J. They pulled the plug on Ugla. Now, obviously, there's a difference in defense and base running, and there are more things that B.J. can do. But is it finally getting close to a point where something changes with B.J. Upton's situation?
I think it has to. This is a team that they collapsed in September just 3 years ago. They understand how big of a how vital this final month is, whether, you can either lose everything or you can gain everything, here in this last month. I just think we have reached a point where they do have options for B.J. Upton, and I think that it's time to start exploring them. I know that Freddie has probably at times probably felt like the front office, pressuring him into playing B.J. just because of the contract. Time and again, I've been told that that's not the case. It doesn't matter sometimes what you hear, though. Freddie knows what he's feeling. But at the same time, look, this is everyone has to be looking at this as, do or die type of situation. There's just no reason to have B.J. Upton in their lineup. So you put Emilio Bonifacio in there some days. The other thing that it's going to be interesting to see if Freddie goes there is he keeps saying that he's not willing to do it quite yet, but move Phil Gosselin to left, put Jason Hayward in center, and put Justin Upton right. And I think that's something that could work. And then also, in doing that, you keep Bonifacio on your bench. And I don't know if everyone on that coaching staff sees Bonifacio as an everyday player. They see his value, the versatility that he brings off the bench. So I think that may be where they're more comfortable of the two choices, but Freddie has continued to say when I've asked, he's not willing to put Gosselin out there yet, but we'll see. We'll see here in the next week or so.
Is that notion that was floated earlier in the year of Gattis as an outfielder even some of the time completely dead, or was it ever real in the first place?
Yeah, it was real. It was a conversation. Probably multiple conversations. I just think that if you go back and you look at Gattis's negative 10 defensive WAR out there in left field last year, I think that's where the conversation always led to and then probably ended. And it made sense on a lot of fronts. But if as somebody said, you saw him out there last year, and they just, yes. In other words, all the other parts of the argument make sense, but you know, when you think about what Gattis did in left field last year, it could be a defensive detriment again.
Makes sense to me. Mark Bowman, thanks for joining us. Going to be talking some Miami Marlins with MLB.com's Marlins beat reporter, Joe Fusaro. Joe, this is a team that's very interesting this year and very exciting this year and having a really surprising and terrific year. But hanging over it all last winter, all this year, all next winter, and until he's either signed or traded, is Giancarlo Stanton's future. What do you see as far as that enormous topic with this club?
Well, I see, you know, the Stanton saga will be something, as you say, will be the biggest offseason story probably in baseball, but nothing really has changed since the day he showed up in South Florida to start spring training and told me that he was looking for franchise stability and not wanting to talk extension at that time, and nothing has changed. Stories are written every few days. Speculation has risen, but from what I have gathered and on pretty solid authority, the Marlins have no intentions of moving him in the offseason with or without an extension. He's not a free agent until after the 16th season, and they think they're going to be pretty good in 15 and in 16, and they have every intention to build around him. But that said, stories will come out. Giancarlo will say what he says. It's clear that there's a lot of distance and ground to make up if a long-term contract were to be worked out. But as I noted, I think the team is ready to go, with or without.
One thing you've mentioned often is that direction of the franchise thing, that it's not necessarily just going to be about the contract terms, but about him having a winner to play for. Do you get the impression that he is impressed or pleased with the signs in that regard?
Yes, I do. I think he is. I think he wants to see more, and rightfully so. It's been an underachieving franchise for a long time with a history of a lot of moves and instability. I also see a player who is, very mature at age 24. He'll be 25 in November. A guy that's reaching his prime and kind of recognizing that he has the chance to be a historical player if healthy, much like Miguel Cabrera, a decade earlier with the Marlins. And Stanton, is putting himself in a very elite category and making himself, hey, look, he may ultimately want to test the market because he's going to be one of the, if he keeps tracking as is, one of the top three players, position players in the sport probably by the time he hits free agency. And much like LeBron James did, if he wanted to test the market, he went back to Cleveland. I would not be surprised if Stanton, something about California, he was born and raised here and he seems to love playing here. I would not be surprised if that's his end game, that he would love to be on the West Coast. But in the meantime, back to your question of the direction, yes, the team has put some nice pieces in place. Obviously, they need Jose Fernandez back, and they're hopeful by the All-Star break next year, and their intention is to get a frontline starting pitcher, another one to try to bridge that gap and make this pitching staff even better and making this team an even stronger contender in 15. And, Stanton, he's liked. Obviously he's well-liked here. He likes the clubhouse. He likes the culture that's being there. But like anything, it's got to be more than a 5-6 month process. It's got to be a more long-distance plan. And I think both sides are working in that direction as whether or not a deal could get done to make that marriage last beyond the next couple of years.
We turn to the club on the field this year. After being one of the best stories of the first half, it's been kind of a slog for Casey McGee here lately. They bumped him down. It's a pretty big problem if this is not a slump, but in fact regression, and the first few months were the outlier. Are there alternatives? Is there some other way they can look, or are they really kind of is the only option to hope that he gets right and keeps holding up the middle of that lineup?
Well, they're seeing him as, their third baseman in 15 as well. And they're hoping that, he gets back to that approach and those solid line drives and the gaps and driving in those big runs. Obviously, he was tracking for a very, very strong, all-star caliber season and 100 RBI type season Obviously, it's going to fall short of that. But, you know, there's still a lot of good stuff in the approach. I think personally, Matthew, I think he's kind of worn down a little bit. You know, this team is being asked to make up a lot of ground, and their regulars are being run out there, you know, all the time until they're no longer in it. And I think that's what you're going to kind of see. And I see a guy that probably could use a little bit of a couple of days off here and there, but because of the situation, didn't get it. So, you know, he is 31, and, you know, he spent last year in Japan as well. So I think there's, you know, some of those factors going into it. Obviously, if he's going to hit fourth or fifth in this lineup, they're going to need more than three home runs. The RBIs are great, but, you know, the power, and that's one reason why Marcell Ozuna with 19 homers is slid into the cleanup spot. But, you know, Casey's a guy they're counting on. You know, he's a real professional. He's very well-liked. He's a team leader. And he's a guy they're moving forward with. But, if you know, they'd obviously like to see a strong finish to reinforce that he's the guy to go with in 15 as well.
One other spot, the spot really, that's been kind of a question for this team all year is second base. They took a flyer on Jordani Valdespin, who is a guy that personally I love to watch, so I was really hoping he would succeed. And it seems like he's kind of reverted to being Jordani Valdespin. What's the situation going forward at second base for the Marlins?
Yeah, it's going to be a interesting final month and week, you know, where, you know, this team, Solano and Valdespin, and then Kike Hernandez probably get a September call-up. Whether Derek Dietrich gets back on the field, you know, he could get a look as well. Those guys are going to be given an opportunity to get a look through there at second base. I think Kike is a guy that when they made the trade with Houston, they saw, hey, this guy, obviously a controllable guy, will be on the team in the utility role, if nothing else, next year. But, you know, guy, a possibility to win that second base job. But I fully anticipate, Matthew, in the offseason, second base will be something they're targeting, because I think they ideally would like that speed guy to move Yelich to number two hole in front of Stanton. And go with, you know, Yelich, Stanton, and Ozuna hitting, you know, 2, 3, 4, and, you know, guys that have made up, you know, arguably the best outfield in the National League this year to be hitting in a row. But before, you know, do anything with Yelich, you're going to need a guy who's more prototypical, get on base, you know, great speed at the top of the order. And second base right now is what profiling, and that's the position I fully anticipate spending a lot of time in the offseason making phone calls on.
You mentioned Christian Yelich, and we talked some about the outfield overall last week, but, you know, I keep an eye on this team, and I didn't realize just how good he had been for something like 2 or 3 months now. Numbers are really ridiculous over an extended period of time, and it's kind of buried by the slow start. It's kind of a dumb question, but how good a player is this guy right now? Is he an all-star caliber player right now, this minute?
Yeah, I mean, the power numbers aren't, you know, up there with the Carlos Gomez. This is in, you know, some of the real elite, you know, National League outfielders in the McCutcheons, the Puig. But, you know, just the approach, the pure hitter. I mean, Matthew, you probably looked at his splits. He's hitting really well against left-handers, surprisingly. You know, pleasantly surprisingly. Now, he always kind of laughs about it because last year he didn't do so well once he got called up. But, you know, his track record in the minors, he hit lefties well as well. Just kind of a gamer, too, you know, a kid who's just, you know, pretty much, you know, everyone, Juan Pierre being the first guy to ballpark was always legendary with the Marlins. Yelich is kind of taking the mantle. He's, you know, he's kind of the first guy there every day. And, you know, just, you know, a kid who just plays winning baseball, does all the little things. When he hits leadoff, you know, he can run the ball out of the ballpark, hits the ball in the gaps. He's starting to drive some runs in, which I think earlier in the season, in those scoring positions, he got a little antsy, maybe trying to do too much. But, you know, here's a guy who they fully anticipate by the time he's just 22 as well. They anticipate by the time he's 24, 25, he's going to be a bona fide all-star.
I look at the numbers and kind of the all-around skill set and kind of overall ability. And the guy that comes to my mind is Nick Markakis. And, you know, Markakis isn't quite the player he was 5 years ago, but he was that all-around, good approach, get on base, play defense, do everything. Do you think that's a decent parallel for the kind of player Yelich is becoming?
Yeah, I think they'd be very happy to see that. And just, you know, just something for down the road and something to keep an eye on. I mean, obviously, when you got in Marlins Park, as big as it is, and there's no indication we're going to move fences in any time soon, so you need a left fielder that can move. And while Yelich's arm isn't great, he covers ground out there. So I don't anticipate him leaving left field, but first base is a position that he played a little bit in high school as well. And if Garrett Jones, who's signed for one more year next year, but whether or not he's their choice next year remains to be seen. Yelich could be a guy in a year or two, because sometimes it's easier to find that, you know, power outfield cornerback than to get a first baseman. So I wouldn't even be surprised if in the, you know, there's at least some sort of talk about Yelich at first base down the line. But as of now, clearly he's in left field.
Joe Fusaro, thanks for taking a few minutes here on MLB.com Extras. Getting ready to talk some New York Mets with MLB.com's Mets beat reporter, Anthony DiComo. It has been a pretty interesting and busy week in Mets land, and there's a lot of things going on. But one thing I actually intended to ask about last week that we didn't get to is the ongoing David Wright situation. As we talk, he has 2 extra base hits and 145 plate appearances since the All-Star break. That looks like more than a slump to me. Is he still, I mean, even given the recent neck issue, is he still saying that his shoulder is not an issue?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Every time David Wright is asked about his shoulder, you know, the questions usually take the form of, are you hurt or what's hurt or anything like that. And he doesn't really answer it directly. His answer to those types of things is typically something along the lines of, well, if I'm in the lineup, I expect to produce. So, you know, he's not necessarily denying that the shoulder is a factor. He just doesn't want to call attention to it. You know, he does still get treatment on it all the time. I don't think it's as much of a factor as it maybe was 3 or 4 weeks ago. That being said, there are definitely some people in the clubhouse, some people in the training staff, manager Terry Collins among them, who think, you know, when it really was at its worst, the shoulder forced him to change some things with his mechanics, with his swing. Guys do that unconsciously all the time, you know, just to try and be comfortable up there at the plate. And he got into some bad habits that are really affecting him now. You know, I don't think anyone really believes that David Wright aged this much overnight. He's 31. He's definitely at the age when people start to decline a little bit, but not like this. This is more than a slump. This is more than just regression. You know, this is a worrisome issue for the Mets, and as they fall further and further out of this thing, you have to wonder if it might be best for all parties involved to just, you know, have him sit down for a while, have him really get himself right so that you're not worrying about this going into the offseason or going into next season.
Right, and I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but and this reminds me very much of there's some ways in which it's almost eerily similar to the stuff I covered with Scott Rolen several years back. It's very clear he's not going to take himself out, and that's fine. At what point, and it sounds like maybe the manager's not either, at some point does the front office put in a call to the manager? I mean, does something happen where somebody says, look, we love you, thanks for all you're doing, thanks for suffering for us, but this isn't doing anybody any good. You need to sit for a while?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tricky situation. You have a star player, the star player on the team, in the franchise, you know, the guy who's probably more important than, you know, just about anyone in the franchise. And he's saying he's fine. He's saying he's good to go. Then you have a manager, you know, who would be the guy who has the authority to go ahead and say, you know, you're not good, we'll take you out. But, you know, this is a manager who's worried about his own job. You know, maybe he's not necessarily in quote-unquote hot water, but there's no guarantees that he's going to be the guy going forward. So the last thing he wants to do is ruffle the feathers of you know, the big fish in town. So, yeah, maybe it comes to that where everyone has to sit down at an open table and just have a meeting, you know, the player, the manager, the front office, and really decide what's best going forward. You know, it's tough. It's a tough situation because the front office doesn't like to get involved in day-to-day player personnel decisions. But if they deem that this is a situation that's going beyond that realm, that's going beyond the day-to-day, and it becomes something that could really affect the direction of the franchise, then it's a conversation that, you know, they're going to need to have. You know, for now, it's just sort of that day-to-day thing. And I think everyone around the team or in the clubhouse is just hoping that, you know, kind of goes away and David Wright becomes David Wright again without having to go to that next step.
Yeah, I mean, you hinted at something in a game story recently, and it was also the topic of a column from Marty Noble a little while back, that you don't it's difficult to say delicately or carefully because you don't actually hope he's hurt, and yet at the same time, there's some degree to which if there's not something physically compromised, then this is extremely alarming. I mean, is that an accurate way to put it?
No, absolutely. I mean, if you're a Mets fan or if you're anyone in the organization, you sure do hope that David Wright is hurt right now, because if this is what he's become, and I don't think anyone thinks he's going to be the player he was in 06, 07 ever again. You know, that 300-hitting, 30-homer monster, that's just not who he is at this point in his career. But this isn't who he is either. At least that's what you have to hope if you're a Mets fan. And if it winds up that he's, you know, he's fine, he's healthy, his swing is intact, and this is just who he's become, that's a huge issue for a team that's got this guy signed through 2020 that's eating up a monster portion of their payroll. So, the best-case scenario for the Mets is that he's hurt. And that, you know, an off-season of rest is going to make him right, and, you know, he can sort of pick up where he left off last year in 2015.
So in hopes that all of the Mets fans listening don't turn this off, let's talk to about a slightly brighter topic. After a little bit of a slow start, Bartolo Colon has been exactly the pitcher the Mets were hoping they were signing and expecting they were signing for quite some time now. That puts them in an enviable position where if they want to, maybe they can get something for him. What's the kind of thought process in the front office as they ponder whether to bring him back for another year or to part with him to bolster the organization?
Yeah, the Mets are kind of in a really nice situation with Bartolo because they have him signed for another year. He's owed $11 million next year, and he's going to be 42 years old, which sounds like it should be a disaster, but you know, he's having a great year. He's having about as good a year as you could hope a 41-year-old pitcher could have, and he's the type of guy who could really help a contender. Now, all that being said, the Mets don't need to trade him. You know, they sort of have a full rotation next year even without him, and it would probably serve them well to get a really nice piece for him in return. But they don't need to force anything before the waiver trade deadline. If they don't get an offer that they like or some team claims just to block another team from getting him, they don't have to go out of their way to get something done. They can wait until the winter when, you know, you see these free agent starting pitchers going off the board at 4 years, $60 million, you know, 5 years, $65 million, things like that for guys who aren't even of Colon's caliber. That's the time when they think they can sit down and really hash out a good deal with a team that's in need of starting pitching. So I think there's definitely a reasonable chance that something gets done this week by a team that's in the hunt. But the Mets aren't going to force it. And if there's one thing Sandy Alderson is good at, it's the slow play when it comes to these negotiations. And he's more than willing to walk away from the table if it doesn't really break in his favor.
Well, one guy who could be a part of that rotation next year, you had an item on recently, Noah Syndergaard. They're being very careful with him, it sounds like. He's been pitching pretty decent lately, but it seems like part of what's going on here is he has not had that great a year. What's the organization's read beyond whether he sees any time in the big leagues this year is just to kind of how he's pitched overall this year?
Yeah, he's just been completely inconsistent. And, you know, at first you like to chalk that up to the ballpark. You know, Las Vegas is probably the foremost hitter's park in the minor leagues. And so you like to chalk a little bit up to that. But he's just been wildly inconsistent. He's had outings when he's gone out, 7 scoreless, struck out 10, and then the next time out, you know, he'll give up 5 or 6 runs in the first inning. It's kind of an interesting thing because this is a kid who, back in February, it was sort of a foregone conclusion that we were going to see him in July or August, if not sooner. That's what Matt Harvey did. That's what Zach Wheeler did. And, Noah Syndergaard was as good, if not better, of a prospect than both of them. But he just hasn't done it. He hasn't been able to figure it out. So it's going to be, you know, it's time's running out. He's up against an innings limit. If he only has a few starts left, you know, Vegas is going to be going to the playoffs. So by the time he sort of rights himself, he's probably going to be out of innings. The Mets could say, we'll call you up just to get a taste. We'll maybe pitch you out of the bullpen, have you get a couple innings or maybe even a start or two. But it's looking unlikely. And that really hurts his chances. Like I said, this is a full stocks rotation coming into 2015. And if he doesn't have any big league experience coming under his belt coming to spring training, it might be difficult for him to fight for a job right out of the gate. And you know, he might have to wait a couple months into next season before he finally gets the call.
Speaking of young Mets pitchers, because there are a ton of them, another guy who a few years ago looked like he might be part of the rotation for years to come, Henry Mejia has had a tough time here lately and is apparently dealing with some fairly significant physical issues. To put it bluntly, why is he still pitching?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the answer that the Mets give is, you know, this is a kid who's basically never been healthy. He came up when in 2010. I believe he was 20 years old at the time. And almost immediately, you know, went through this series of elbow and shoulder injuries. And he finally got out of all that last year and, you know, really had a nice year and made it back to the big leagues. And now this year he's just had all these little nagging injuries. It's been one after the other. It seems almost every week something new pops up. And you know, you start to wonder how much, and the Mets have sort of wondered this aloud, is how much of this is him really being hurt and how much of this is him being so sensitive to, you know, having his arm issues in the past that every little ache and pain now, you know, he wants to sit down. But to answer your question, the reason why they're sort of pushing him out there and continuing to have him pitch despite all this is because, you know, they think it's important that he finish this year healthy and get through a full season, you know, without having to go down, without having to go on the disabled list, you know, because they look at this and they look at what I just said, a guy who is worried about his health all the time. If he gets through a full season healthy, you know, maybe he can stop worrying. He can say, well, I can do this and I can do it in this role, you know, as a closer, as a relief pitcher and not have to worry about my health. And then it's something they won't have to worry about going forward. Now, is that the right decision? I don't know. If it's health issues that can't be exacerbated by pitching, which obviously the Mets believe they are, you know, maybe it is. But he is a significant piece of the future. So you wonder if the Mets are doing the right thing, continuing to send him out there when he's clearly not 100%.
Does that also mean that there's not really anything on the table as far as his role? Is he the ninth inning guy for the remainder, or is that at least something that might be addressed as these last few weeks go on?
Yeah, I mean, as long as he's healthy, he's going to close out this year, you know, being that ninth inning guy, but I don't think there's any guarantees going forward. It's not like he's performed fine in the role, but it's not like he's done so well that the Mets couldn't take him out of it. You know, they have another guy in Harris Familia who's had the best year of anyone in the bullpen, throws hard, looks really good, and, you know, could be that answer as a closer going forward. You know, Vic Black's a guy they've talked about in the past as a potential closer, and they might want to look at him again. And then you have Bobby Parnell, who will probably be back to full strength sometime around May or June next year. And the Mets are still sort of looking to him as their closer if no one's really seized the role before he gets back. So it's going to be interesting. I think he is going to get every shot to fail in the role, but there's no guarantees that he's still going to be closing for the Mets come, you know, next April or May.
And Anthony Acomo, thanks for taking a few minutes to stop by and chat Mets. We'll be talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies beat reporter, Todd Zielecki. Todd, one last chance for me to ask this. Any moves coming in the next few days before the non-waiver deadline?
I would – everything can change, certainly, with one phone call, but as of this moment, I don't think so. Talking to Ruben Amaro Jr. recently, he said there is a chance. But you look at the most attractive guys that they could trade. Cole Hamels was claimed earlier this month by the Cubs. Marlon Byrd's been claimed. Claim was made on Grady Sizemore, who, you know, could be valuable as a extra outfielder perhaps. So the guys that have cleared waivers, guys like Jonathan Papelbon and A.J. Burnett, I don't see them getting traded. Certainly not Burnett. He's really struggled since the All-Star break. But if I've learned anything covering baseball, is that, like I just mentioned, anything can change with one phone call. So if a team gets desperate for a closer and owner puts some pressure on the GM and says, we need some bullpen help, then maybe Papelbon gets moved. But other than that, I really don't see anything coming right now.
You mentioned Papelbon, and I was just looking, and I shouldn't realize what a good year he's having. Is there any pressure just to move him while he's having this bounce-back year, or at least in the winter at some point, to capitalize on that before he kind of – it's not a given that he falls off, but he's having an awfully good year, and I don't think you assume he does that again next year.
Right. I do think that they are going to really double their efforts in the offseason to try to trade him. You know, I think one of the roadblocks they ran into this year is that he was still owed a lot of money, and he's making $13 million next year with an option – for the year after that at $13 million. So the money is definitely an issue, but I think what they are hoping is that once the offseason begins, the offseason signing period, and you know teams can start talking about trades and whatnot or making trades, that the involvement of 29 teams as opposed to just a couple contending teams that need bullpen help is going to increase their chances. But it has been a challenge to trade Papelbon. I think last offseason the challenge was is he kind of struggled down the stretch and blew more than his share of saves. But the fact that he's pitching so well right now, I think they're going to try to present it to teams as this guy is still at the top of his game, and we're willing to eat some money. So you know, how can you not take Jonathan Papelbon at, say, $6.5 million a year instead of 13, which is what the Phillies are paying? You telling me you can't use a closer of that caliber for $6.5 or $8 million a year? I think that's going to be the way that they try to pitch it to teams.
Another guy you mentioned who it doesn't seem like is going anywhere is Grady Sizemore. And you had something this week that said that they're maybe thinking about keeping him around beyond this year. Do they think that this, whatever it is, 100 at-bats or so, is real and that he's becoming more of what he used to be? Or is there some concern that this is basically the best 100 at-bats he's had in whatever it is, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, there definitely is some of that, some concern that this is a guy with an extensive injury history and, you know, how much are you really going to be able to get out of him? From what I've been told and kind of what I've gleaned over the past few weeks is if they do bring back Grady Sizemore, they think it could be in a situation of him platooning in left field with Darren Ruff. And that is if they just don't believe that Dominic Brown can play anymore. But, you know, if a team gets aggressive on Grady Sizemore for whatever reason and believes more strongly about his abilities in the Phillies and they offer him a 2-year deal, I would be stunned if the Phillies bring him back. I mean, I don't think they look at him as an everyday type of player. And so that and therefore, I think if a team would make an everyday type of player contract offer for him in the offseason, I think the Phillies will let him go. But they are intrigued by the possibility of a platoon, and they do look at him as an option. Like I said, if Dominic Brown, if they just decide, you know what, Dominic Brown's not going to get this thing fixed and turned around.
And that actually leads me into the next thing I wanted to ask. As we sit here talking, in the last 7 days, Darren Ruff has 6 plate appearances. He's got 400 big league plate appearances that say he's maybe not a star, but certainly a good enough hitter to play a corner in the big leagues. 350 on base, 480 slugging. That's a pretty good player. Why is this guy at this point in this season not at least getting semi-regular playing time?
Yeah, that's the thing that really has Phillies fans riled up. That because there's a lot of mixed messages. You hear Ryan Sandberg talk. You know, we talk to him every day, obviously, and we'll say, you know, do you think you know enough about Darren Ruff? And Ryan Sandberg will say, no, I don't think we know enough about Darren Ruff. We need to learn more about this guy. But then, like you just mentioned, he doesn't play. And from talking to sources, this is kind of the gist with him. While Ryan Sandberg says, we don't know what we have yet, we need to see more of Darren Ruff, the Phillies front office feel that they know what they have in Darren Ruff. They think that he could be a good platoon-type player, but not an everyday player. So they feel that they actually have a pretty firm grasp of his abilities. And the thing that's kind of working against him right now is they are playing Ryan Howard every day at first base. And last month, Ryan Sandberg said, you know, I want to see some other people at first base. You know, I'm not worried about Ryan Howard's contract. When I make out the lineup, I'm trying to win ball games here. Then, like, a couple days later, that plan was entirely scratched. And basically, it comes down to this. Even if the Phillies have, like, a 5% chance of trading Ryan Howard or a 10% chance, whatever number you would put on him in the offseason, assuming the Phillies need a huge portion of the remaining $60 million on his deal, they basically think, like I said, 5% chance, 10% chance, 20% chance, that number goes down to zero if you stop playing Ryan Howard. So right now they want to play Ryan Howard every day. Maybe he finishes the season, has a good month to finish the season. Maybe he keeps playing like he is, and maybe he still finishes in the top 5, top 10 in the National League in RBIs. And then they would take those numbers in the offseason and say, hey, we're going to eat a bunch of his money. Hey, American League team, you telling me you couldn't use Ryan Howard as a DH for $5 million a year? That's kind of the hope, I think, for the Phillies right now. And again, that number goes down to zero if they don't play him. So now Darren Ruff loses some playing time because he's not doesn't have a chance to play at first base. And then in left field, you've got Dominic Brown, who they're still hoping they could, you know, please, Dominic, give us some signs that you can hit and get this thing turned around. They want to play Grady Sizemore enough to keep him happy. So if they decide to move on from Dominic Brown, you know, they have an option of re-signing Grady Sizemore. And then in the shuffle, then Darren Ruff basically doesn't play much, despite, like you mentioned, a pretty good sample size, you know, spread out over a couple seasons in terms of power on base percentage and whatnot. So Darren Ruff right now is kind of caught between the Ryan Howard situation and, you know, Darren and Dominic Brown struggles and Grady Sizemore's possibility in coming back.
It's fairly amazing that a team that really is not talking about, I mean, they're talking some about retooling, but still really wants to win games this year. It just seems to me this guy's one of the four or five best hitters in the club and
right.
could use the plate appearances. But I understand where you're coming from. It's not an ideal situation, and that sort of complicates matters for the next guy I want to ask about. And again, it's weird for a team struggling to have too many guys, but I do wonder, is there any opportunity down the stretch for Michael Franco, who's really raking once again these last couple of weeks in AAA?
Yeah, that's another thing. Now, if Darren Ruff has got Phillies fans fired up because he's not playing for all these different reasons or the various reasons, and then if Michael Franco doesn't get called up in September, I think Phillies fans are really going to go nuts. But I don't think it's a given. And again, just from conversations I've had with people, those roadblocks that we just mentioned, they feel that they have to play Ryan Howard to have any shot of trading him in the offseason. So now Michael Franco's a corner infielder. So now you're not really going to play him that much at first base the last month of the season. And at third base, they do still like Cody Ashe. They still think he could be an everyday third baseman. And if not, you know, maybe a possibility in left field, but they still want to play him the rest of the year. So where are his at-bats going to come from? But personally, I think you got to call this guy up. You got to find him some playing time. But the Phillies, so many moving parts right now in a bad team, and I really think it does come down to trading Howard or trying to trade him in the offseason and just trying to free up a roster spot for a more productive bat.
As hot as he's been lately, is there some worry about the adjustment? I mean, Franco's still a young guy. Seems like he's got, you know, not a terrible strike. He doesn't strike out a lot, but, he seems like a guy who, with the adjustment he had at AAA, is there any worry that if you do bring him up too soon that maybe he's not ready, even as hot as he's been?
Yeah, there is some concern of that. There's some concern of, if we bring him up and say we can only play him once or twice a week, you know, how much does that help him? There's some concern of, you know, this is a really, you know, bad team right now. And, you know, do you want to bring him up into this atmosphere late in the season when, you know, guys are all frustrated and, you know, kind of, I don't want to say checked out, but, you know, they definitely see the end of a long, grueling season ahead of them. And, you know, do you want to put him in that type of atmosphere? So they want to keep this guy, as productive as possible. So these are all things I think they're really going to talk about going, you know, the next week really before September call-ups. But I just know this, if he does not get called up, I don't know what kind of, however well Ruben can explain it, he's going to take a lot of heat for it because the fans want to see some signs of some changes, and right now there just aren't any signs of those changes.
All right. Well, that sounds like fun. Todd Zalecki, thanks for joining us here on MLB.com Extras. Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras, National League East.